In this section of our looking at the 19th century, I'd like to highlight in portion 5 that I've labeled medical prestige and paternalism, the increasing commitment during the 19th century to a practice of medicine based on science, that is, science based on observation and repeatable experiments that can be performed in another laboratory than your own by someone who may even be skeptical of your results. That commitment was slow in growing, but gradually did acquire its own momentum. And little by little, scientists and physicians gradually came to regard each other as, to some extent, co-workers, and one even began to speak of the science of medicine, or medical science, even though, in fact, medicine is rather more a general art that makes use of whatever sciences are useful in the treatment of disease and the diagnosis of disease. Well, during the 19th century, there was a progressive desire to identify and then to distance orthodox medicine from fringe therapies, or what I've called fringe therapies. And I've given you some examples there in the pictures that are under section 5.1, and I've mentioned a couple of others in the text. And I've cheated slightly in that radium water is actually something that was available at the very end, or became available at the end of the 19th century, and was actually much more popular in the early 20th century. Scientific discoveries, which appear to be very earth-shattering and exciting to people, are often incorporated rather willy-nilly into what are hoped will be medical cures or treatments, and then, unfortunately, it often turns out that they're not only not helpful, but sometimes harmful. That was certainly the case with radium water. It was discovered or thought that radium might be beneficial in the treatment of certain illnesses, certain kinds of cancers, and those kinds of treatments were attempted with varying degrees of success even later in the 20th century, but the idea of simply drinking radioactive water because it might make you better was, of course, extremely dangerous, and radiothor and other similar products were investigated vigorously and taken off the market, particularly after a rather renowned businessman who had drunk thousands of bottles of this material had to have portions of his jaw and face surgically removed because of the cancers that he developed. Similarly, the idea of an electric bath, whatever that's supposed to mean, probably electrical discharge during a steam bath. This is, by the way, a bath, a form of relaxation that was available on the Titanic, but had been available rather widely before then. Such cures as that, and who knows what the electric corset entailed. These sorts of bizarre devices, which were both fascinating to people and at the same time offered them no particular treatment, were progressively investigated and discarded, as were pseudosciences like phrenology, of which you have a chart there in the upper right-hand corner, which was supposedly the ability to identify different regions of the brain responsible for different capabilities by the shape of the skull over the brain, which, of course, is, as we know now today, quite ludicrous. Other more widespread practices included the application of magnets to various parts of the body with the expectation that this would heal a person. It's lamentable that such devices can still be found on the internet with people claiming that they have some efficacy. Well, medicine was in process of defining itself as more scientific and acquiring greater respectability. This was accelerated as well by a codification of what Thomas Percival, a physician who trained and practiced in the late 18th century, but whose writings became more popular and more widely known in the early 19th century, what Percival called medical ethics. And the term medical ethics for him, and up till the present time, has generally meant in medical curricula not what we would call biomedical ethics, but rather what might more properly be termed medical decorum. What is the proper form of behavior, and what are the proper professional standards for physicians and surgeons? Percival penned his book, Medical Ethics, based on a pamphlet that he put together during a very notorious strike that took place in the Manchester Royal Infirmary, which resulted in interruption of patient care and which became a source of local scandal. Percival, a noted practitioner of medicine and writer at the time, was invited to try to write something that would calm these troubled waters, and he did. And his medical jurisprudence, or a code of ethics and institutes adapted to the professions of physic and surgery, later became medical ethics. And this is an important contribution, particularly in that the text that I've highlighted below the pictures in the section devoted to Percival, section 5.2, the text that I've highlighted was incorporated word for word into the first code of medical ethics of the then developing American Medical Association, the AMA. Notice the phraseology: physicians should minister to the sick with due impressions of the importance of their office. They should study also in their deportment so to unite tenderness with firmness and condescension with authority as to inspire the minds of their patients with gratitude, respect, and confidence. I hope you can see the extreme contrast between this kind of advice and what we saw depicted in the very early Hippocratic documents, in which there is a clear recognition that philanthropia, the love of humankind, is a quality of kindliness that is to inspire a respect for, a trust in, even a love of the medical art, philotechnia, on the part of the patient. Percival's text implies not so much that the physician is obligated to inspire this, to encourage this, but rather he has a right to expect it, that in a condescending, that is to say, recognizing that he has been highly educated, where his patient has been not, way, he can speak or she can speak authoritatively, and the patient's response should be one of gratitude, respect, and confidence. So we have a shift from patient autonomy, from the patient making the decision whether or not to participate in therapy, deciding what they would do or not do, to an expectation on the part of the medical establishment that the patient, and the word patient is actually the same root word as the English word passive, patiens, the person who is experiencing something done to them, the attitude of the patient should be a passive one. And this indeed is the developing mindset as the 19th century wears on into the 20th century, and it is accelerated by, or it is increased by, the factors that we've already discussed, namely medical advances, which the public regards as responsible for improvements in the possibility of living longer, which is not necessarily due to medical advances per se, but often more to do with hygiene, as we've mentioned. And then, as I've mentioned in the last paragraph of this little section, the conviction that you not only should, but you always must trust your doctor. This mindset becomes firmly embedded within popular culture. There's a very great difference between the physicians who were satirized in Molière's play and the profound respect for the developing Victorian physician, who is a gentleman whose word can be taken, who is regarded as someone who is above reproach. Now, this attitude will remain, as we'll see, and will be powerfully challenged and will shatter following World War II and the revelations at the Nuremberg trials of what actually happened with the medical establishment in Germany, and which was paralleled by the medical establishment in other Axis nations, particularly in Japan. But that's to get ahead of ourselves. We'll now continue on with, drop down to number 6, Pius IX and the human embryo, that is, the articulations of the magisterium at the end of the 19th century in regard to the beginning of life. A great deal has been made of Pius IX's bull, that is to say, his official pronouncement, Apostolicae Sedis Moderationi, that he significantly articulated and, in some sense, changed, although I believe we'll see that, in fact, he was articulating a clear line of development of Catholic doctrine, which is being effectively transformed into clear canonical penalties in this articulation of the magisterium, which has the effect of ratifying the tradition of abortion being a sin that requires, that has as its effect an automatic excommunication, and an excommunication that is reserved to the ordinary, that is, to the local bishop. That's effectively what this document did. That had already been, as we've seen, in place for some centuries, but there is no mention here of early or late abortions, of animate or inanimate, formed or unformed. The question naturally arises, what is the reason for this? What is the rationale behind it? Well, in fact, this document is not a papal encyclical. That is, it doesn't include all the explanations and the theological reflection that a letter might include. It's simply a statement of canonical penalties. And as we'll see, I've given you this penalty together with a couple of others. What one can assume, and this is an assumption, because again, you cannot prove this on the basis of the document itself, that there were a number of factors that made it clear why the development of doctrine should move in this particular direction, or why the articulation of the magisterium should be this at this time. And I've suggested that in number 1, 6.1, that part of this would be advances in embryology. The use of the microscope, the observation of other mammalian embryos and of spontaneously aborted human embryos, enabled embryologists to pretty accurately begin to describe what the human embryo looked like very early in gestation, which had not been possible earlier, or which had not been done earlier, and had certainly not been possible in classical antiquity. And so the early attempt to distinguish between the embryo prior to 40 days and after, and to claim that it was either unformed or not ensouled or something of that sort, simply could not hold up to inspection. The science was making it clearer that those older distinctions were artificial and actually bad science. And I've given you a couple of examples of embryological texts that were becoming very widely known. One from a late 18th century embryologist, Caspar Friedrich Wolff, and the other from Karl Ernst von Baer, who worked primarily in the 19th century, and it was he who in 1827 first described the human egg cell, the human oocyte. So the science was making it clear that there really was no basis for this arbitrary distinction between animate and inanimate. Another interesting observation is that it was Pope Pius IX who articulated, proclaimed the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, which of course had been taught and had been believed in centuries before. But it was he who articulated this and felt it important, and when one reflects on the theological significance of this, one is faced with something similar to the Christological reflections that had occurred in St. Thomas Aquinas that began the process of saying, well, what do we think about humans based on what we think happened in Christ? Well, what do we think happens in humans based on what we believed happened in the human being, the completely human being, the Blessed Virgin Mary? If we proclaim that the Blessed Virgin Mary, from the very first moment of her conception, was freed from all taint of original sin, then the question of inheriting or being subject to or not being subject to original sin must apply from the very first moment of conception, not at some later point. So the idea that there would be a later point when one was perhaps more human, more capable of being subject to sin or not subject to original sin, suddenly no longer applies. If it's possible for this to be said of the Blessed Virgin Mary from the moment of her conception, then that naturally raises the question, expands the discussion to consider conception as clearly a moment of unique humanness and not some later arbitrary point. So what one sees is not a change in church doctrine, but actually a clarification and a development. And so if you drop down to the actual text of Apostolicae Sedis Moderatione, what we have is a statement in number 2 that those who successfully procure an abortion are subject to a late sententiae, that is to say an automatic excommunication, which is reserved to the ordinary, to the local bishop. And that's simply listed among other among other excommunications, the one before it, which happens to be clerics or religious who have made solemn vows and who attempt to marry. So what one has here is a statement by the magisterium of a legal order, but I think one needs to be very clear about the fact, and one needs to try to reflect in one's own heart and mind about the extent to which this genuinely is a development of doctrine. And I've listed for our own reflection and meditation 4 points, 4 periods that we've already looked at. Again, we will continue to see this developing in the 20th century as well, with the clear articulation of the significance of conception in a very unambiguous way in the later 20th century, in the very specifically bioethical documents that we'll be looking at in the next section of the course. But one thing that I'd like to highlight here, and which I haven't as clearly articulated in the text as I might, is that one can see the development of the church also as a development in the application of pastoral concern to the unique moral situation of abortion in accordance with the culture and the circumstances in which those articulations are being made, because pastoral adaptations and pastoral articulations have to be made in a way that can be understood by the culture to which one is speaking. So one can look, for example, at the clear statements by St. Basil in the 4th century that abortion is the moral equivalent of murder, while also recognizing that Basil does not impose the same penalty for abortion as he does for murder, for the very specific reason, the clear reason, and he's very clear about this, that the woman involved is not always what we would today call morally culpable. There is often very great duress, especially in earlier cultures, and therefore the degree of moral imputability is not the same as it would be for someone who engages in, say, homicide for personal gain or out of revenge or something of that sort. So the penance is a lesser, different penance, for the simple reason that although the act is the moral equivalent, the moral circumstances are almost always those that require mitigation. Then the church encounters other cultures, Celtic culture, Germanic culture, which already had in place. And we've seen that's also true of the Judaic culture, of which the early church was aware, and which is clearly articulated in that strangely transformed translation in the Septuagint of the biblical text regarding injury to a pregnant woman. Well, there were Germanic and Celtic cultures that had already distinguished between the severity of a crime, severity of violence, and the degree of reparation, the kind of restitution that had to be made, in which it was regarded as a greater and more significant crime approaching homicide later in pregnancy, later in gestation. So the church's penalties were naturally adapted to, expressed in the language of a culture that already presumed this. The importation of Aristotle's metaphysics and his embryology, biology, in the time of St. Thomas Aquinas and his adoption of this lent a significant amount of what was thought to be scientific and reasonable theological explanation for why the penances that are applied are less than the penalties that are normally applied for murder, and why they would differ at different times of gestation. Now let's jump ahead in time to the 19th century. Suddenly we have a culture in which anesthesia and antisepsis are becoming more available. The consequence of this will be that abortion, which had previously been extremely dangerous and held the danger of death, and therefore would have naturally been looked upon with great reserve, both by women who might be considering it and also by physicians who might be offering it, suddenly the probable availability of this is beginning to increase. And so the need of the church to articulate to this culture, to explain to this culture, the continuously held tradition that abortion is a very serious sin becomes clear. And thus, the Pope's decision to make clear that the excommunication does not depend upon the age of gestation, that abortion is itself a very serious sin, and the reason for articulating articulating that in this very legalistic kind of way will also have to do with attempting to speak the truth that has always been believed to a culture which suddenly has available to it means that were formerly not there, and indeed has a mindset that is already beginning at the end of the 19th century, and which we see tremendously accelerated in our own day, that in some sense abortion is not only could not only be regarded by the social reformers of that era as a necessary evil, but progressively more and more as a kind of a right, as something necessary for women to have control over their own reproductive capabilities. Well, in the wake of that kind of growing sensibility or assertion, the church is concerned for declaring unequivocally the significance of the moral significance of this act. And so I've quoted, although again we're looking at the end of the 19th century, I've quoted the Catechism, number 2272, at the end of this section. The church is not, through this penalty of excommunication, restricting the scope of mercy. Rather, this is a way of making clear the gravity of the crime committed, the irreparable harm done to the innocent put to death, as well as to parents and the whole of society. So again, it's not a question of a change in the church's teaching or practice. On the contrary, it's a question of making clear how to live out and how to understand the church's teaching in a culture which is shifting and changing in its own approach to, its own understanding of abortion.